Okay.
I know what we told you, but you never listened. Yes, he did.
What did you say?
We said that
he was going to go 10 minutes less.
Yeah.
And he was taking 5 minutes all day.
Yeah.
And you said you would like to go and read the thing.
Okay. So let's get started then.
Okay, let's go.
What we saw last time when we discussed the preservation of Tanakh, as we essentially asked the question of to what degree, if we look at the evidence for Jews preserving the text of Chumash or of Tanakh in general, whatever that may come to include, to what degree can we demonstrate that Jews of sort of the late Second Temple period, early post-Second Temple period, to what extent can we demonstrate that they really were good preservers of texts? After all, as we said last time, if it's true that we're going to assert, and if it's true that the basis of our investigation moving forward is going to be that the common heritage uniting the Jews of all different flavors and shapes that we're going to encounter was Chumash and some of the and you know many of the established books of Tanakh, even if some people didn't have Qohelet or some people didn't have Esther, some people had a couple of extra books, Ben Sira or whatever the case may be. The common heritage was more or less what we'll call Tanakh. So it would seem crucial to establish whether or not everybody had the same text, whether or not the text that we have is the same text that they had. And what we saw is that on the whole, on the one hand, there's good evidence that those who are the progenitors of what we would call the Masoretic text is sort of a later construct, but basically the Masoretic text is the tradition of the psukim that underlie what we have in our Sifrei Torah. The word Masoretic comes from the word Masorah, the word of the tradition that's passed on. So those who are committed, or those who are preserving what will eventually come to be known as the Masoretic text, we saw there's good evidence to see that, first of all, they cared to preserve what was in the text. In other words, this was an issue of priority for them, which we shouldn't take for granted. And B, that they were they seem to have been relatively good at it. But we also saw that there's evidence that alterations crept in, both to the Masoretic text and certainly to other traditions of texts, and that there was, we certainly can't claim that all of these differences were negligible. In fact, we saw for quite a while there is evidence of a certain degree of fluidity, not just let's say in something like the Dead Sea Scrolls, but even in things like Unculus among members of Chazal. People sometimes had different versions of what was in our Torah. That said, what we saw was that on the whole, there certainly is a commitment to preserving the text, even if that commitment doesn't always result or doesn't always lead to perfect results. That was essentially the conclusion that we came to last time. So now I want to move the conversation a little bit forward into the topic of this course, the official topic of this course, which is Jews in a Christian empire. So before, of course, now we're still, chronologically speaking, I'd say, just on the cusp of the rise of Christianity, but certainly Christianity does not have imperial power at this point. So what we have to ask ourselves is that, let's say, in the late first century of the Common Era, so Jesus is crucified sometime in the 30s, Paul writes his letters sometime in the 50s, Mark, the Gospel of Mark, which is the earliest gospel that we have, at least of the canonical gospels, is written about 60 to 70. Matthew and Luke follow in the next 20 to 30 years. The book of Acts is written about 96 CE. John is maybe the end of the first century, beginning of the second century. But as these traditions are beginning to develop, so we have to ask ourselves the following question. If it's true that we can demonstrate that there is this degree of sort of responsibility for text that inheres in those Jews who are operative at this time, if people care to preserve texts that are important to them, does this extend as well to newly developing traditions, textual traditions? So again, I'm presupposing here the idea that people preserve the Gospels in writing. Now, this is true. We have lots of papyri, you know, sort of what we would call, material evidence that people were writing the Gospels down, but we also have evidence that people who knew things that are in the Gospels or seemed to know traditions from Gospels weren't writing them down. They were repeating them orally. But that said, there are people who are writing down texts from the Gospels. So would people have been as careful to preserve the words of the Gospel? Or might we say that perhaps because these are quote-unquote newer texts, that people might be more lax in their treatment of these texts and might perhaps add things or not be as careful about letting things get added in or drop out? Or might we perhaps entertain the notion that given that these texts are not that rather the authority of these texts had not yet been established, perhaps people would purposefully introduce things into the text or purposefully might delete things from the text? And then finally, the question we're going to have to ask is if we can come to a conclusion or sort of produce a data set that will allow us to answer these questions, so can we then broaden our net to ask ourselves how Jews in general, right, not just Jews who are followers of Jesus, but Jews in general might have treated their texts? Does this have anything to teach us about how the text of, let's say, Tanakh might be preserved? So the first thing I want to do is look at some of the Christian evidence. It's important to recall that the Gospels were not the Gospels overnight. Originally, the Gospel, the earliest Gospel, as we've said a couple of times over the course of this class, is the Gospel of Mark. We could spend an entire semester going through why we know this to be true, but for now, you'll just have to take it on my authority. The Gospel of Mark is the earliest Gospel. There seems to, and the later Gospels, Matthew and Luke, are drawing upon Mark as a source. They're also drawing upon something that is not Mark, which scholars hypothesize, we don't have a physical copy of it, but given that Matthew and Luke seem to have common traditions that are not found in Mark, so the way that this is usually explained is by referring to a hypothetical source called Q. The reason it's called Q is because in German, Q stands for Quelle, which means source. It's a hypothetical source, and it seems to have been just a collection of sayings of Jesus. So Jesus said blah, 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 blah. Jesus said blah, 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 and so on and so forth. That seems to have been another source for Matthew and Luke. And then Matthew and Luke each had their own independent source of all these other things. So the Gospels, now, it wasn't like these are the only four Gospels ever written. We have lots of other traditions about Jesus that are written. They seem to be quite early relative to some of the other Gospels. But in any event, what we have to ask ourselves is, as these texts are being preserved and as people begin to care about them, so how are they treated, textually speaking? So one of the most important figures in the history of Christianity, and as we'll see in some of the later lectures, in the history of Judaism, when we talk about Christian anti-Semitism, in this respect, is a fellow named Marcion. Marcion of Sinope, from a place called Pontus, which is sort of northeastern, northwestern Turkey nowadays. Marcion is known to history perhaps as the greatest paradigmatic Christian heretic. Now, I call him a heretic. Next time we're going to really dig down on what the word heresy means and how it's used. But just a point of method. So heresy, when we think about heresy, what do we presuppose when we say the word heresy? What must exist if there is to be heresy?
Doctrine.
Doctrine, right? Orthodoxy. There must be an orthodoxy if there's to be a heresy. Now, the word orthodoxy, comes from the Greek words orthos and doxa, which means sharp, straight, or correct belief, right? So the assumption when you say the word orthodoxy and when you say the word heresy is that there originally is this correct, pure belief, and someone comes along and perverts it, right? Those are the heretics. So you have the original orthodox people, and then the heretics come along and pervert it. So this was sort of the standard view of how Christian orthodoxy developed in respect to what we might call Christian heresy. So now, with sort of over the last, you know, let's say 150 some odd years or so, we can demonstrate conclusively that this is in fact not how Christianity developed. There are lots of different opinions about Jesus and what he meant and what his character was and what he meant in with respect to his disciples, who his disciples were, what his intent was to preach to others. So there's lots and lots of disagreement. It happens to be that one party, who eventually come to be known to the world as the Orthodox, basically win out, and then they have their own complicated fights, but the Orthodox eventually win. So when we talk about orthodoxy, we don't mean the original correct belief of Christianity. What we mean are basically the winners. So I'm going to use the words orthodoxy and heresy, not because they denote anything correct, per se, about the history of Christianity, but because it's just a convenient thing to say. So when I say the word orthodox, what I mean are the winners. When I say heretics or heresy, what I mean are basically the losers, even if you know, hypothetically they might be correct and the Orthodox might be wrong. Okay, so Marcion is one of the most famous heretics. And the reason, and he represents a particular type of heresy. So now the problem is we don't really have any of Marcion's writings. What we do have are lots of Christian heresiologists, sort of Christians who are specialists in combating what they believe to be false opinions, heresies. What we have are lots of Christian heresiologists writing about Marcion. So we're going to have to, this is always a very dangerous thing methodologically, but we're going to have to deduce from the heresiologists what it was that Marcion believed. We're going to have to be very careful here in terms of drawing conclusions, and they're going to be speculative at the end of the day, but we're going to be able to do a little bit of good work, I hope. So, take a look at source number one. Source number one is from a fellow named Irenaeus, who was the bishop of Lyon. He's from Gaul, from what we would now, I guess, call France. We're going to meet Irenaeus in more a little bit more depth next week, or maybe 2 weeks from now. But for now, here's what Irenaeus tells us about Marcion. So let's figure out what we can glean about Marcion from Irenaeus. Irenaeus says, Marcion advanced the most daring blasphemy against him who was proclaimed as God by the law and the prophets, declaring him to be the author of evils, to take delight in war, to be infirm of purpose, and even to be contrary to himself. But Jesus, being derived from that Father who is above the God that made the world, and coming into Judea in the times of Pontius Pilate, the governor, who was the procurator of Tiberius, was manifested in the form of a man to those who were in Judea, abolishing the prophets and the law, and all the works of that God who made the world, whom also he calls Cosmocrator. Okay, so what is Irenaeus telling us about Marcion? I think there are at least two or three things we can glean here. What does Marcion believe? First of all, what does Marcion believe about God?
That he's the author of good and evil.
So we have here a sort of a result of my trick question, right? So if you read this passage and you assume that there's one God, as you probably should if you've read the Hebrew Bible, so you will have to conclude that Marcion is quite, or at least Irenaeus is quite confused, right? Because Irenaeus is saying that Marcion believes that God is both good and evil. But in fact, look closely at what Irenaeus says. Irenaeus says, take a look in that second sentence, but Jesus being derived from that Father who is above the God that made the world, right? There is a separate being. There are two gods.
And it's higher than.
And there's one God who's higher than the other. Which God is the God of the Hebrew Bible?
God made the world.
Right. So look at that first sentence.
Jesus is farther than is higher than.
Right. God by the law is who that second is the God of the Hebrew Bible, who we also might call the Cosmocrator, the person who created the world. So the creator God is sort of a lesser evil God. And he's the God who gives the law of Moses and so on and so forth. He's the God responsible for the Torah, Chaman Olitzlan. Whereas Jesus is a manifestation of a higher God who is not revealed in the Hebrew Bible. And that's, I think, point number one we can take away here. And point number two is, what does Marcion think about Jesus? What is the nature of Jesus according to Marcion, at least as Irenaeus portrays it? I'm thinking in particular of that those last two lines, right? He was manifested in the form of a man to those who were in Judea, abolishing the prophets and the law. What was Jesus' job?
To bring the word.
Right, to abolish, right, to get rid of the word of the first God, of the creator God. And more importantly, is Jesus a person? Is he a man?
No.
What does it say? He's in the form of a man. He's in the form of a man. This is an opinion that came to be known by the heresiologists as the heresy of docetism. The word docetism comes from the Greek word dakeo, which is a verb that means to appear. And the reason that they're called docetists is because they believe, according to their opponents, that Jesus is not an actual man, he only appears to be a man. And really, he is divine. These are the two things now that we know about Marcion, at least if Irenaeus is giving us accurate information. Marcion believed that there were two gods, the creator God, the God of the law, and a pure God of whom Jesus is a manifestation. Okay. Now,
Can I ask you, how different is that than in our own belief? Don't say I'm a heretic. when the angels came to visit Abraham, and they came in the form of man.
Ah, right.
And,
so,
and yet they were not really men.
Right. So I think this is a good question. We're going to get to angels a little bit later on in the course, because that's an important issue. Who are angels? What are angels? What is their function? But I think for now, we're just going to set it aside. Simply, I hate to do this because it's such a good question, but we're going to set it aside just for a couple of weeks by saying that even Marcion, I think, would distinguish between mere angels who are servants of God and two different gods who are, in some sense, opposed to each other. Right? In other words, the God of the law and the God of Christianity are opposed to each other, and one is evil and one is good. Okay.
But it doesn't say anything about him being son of God.
Correct. He's not a son of God per se. I mean, he may believe that, but he's not the son, a son in a biological sense. He's sort of a manifestation of God. Right. Okay. Now, Tertullian, who writes an entire book dedicated to disproving what he thinks to disproving Marcion. So Tertullian tells us about Marcion the following. He says, admittedly, and pay attention closely here, because this is a passage in which Tertullian tries to refute an argument of Marcion, and it's my contention that we can derive from this passage precisely why it is that Marcion thinks that there are two different gods. So let's figure out what Marcion's argument is. So Tertullian says, admittedly, Christ teaches a new degree of forbearance when he puts restraint on that retaliation for injury, which the Creator permitted by demanding an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. For he, or Jesus, on the contrary, orders us rather to offer the other cheek, and in addition to the coat, to let go of the cloak also. So evidently, Christ will have added this as supplementary, yet in agreement with the Creator's rules. So Tertullian is making what argument, or if you prefer, what argument must Marcion have been making that Tertullian is responding to? Right, Tertullian here is saying, don't think that to turn the other cheek is rather contradictory of the rule of ayin tachas ayin, of an eye for an eye. They are complementing each other. One is sort of, if we had to put this in sort of Mishnaic terms, we would say one is a reshus, one is a chova, right? Rather, one is a reshus and one is a... Right, those aren't precise terms. We would say one is a reshus and one is a mitzvah, right? We would say that one is permissible and one is laudatory, right? So, Tertullian is going out of his way to explain why, just because Jesus says you have to turn the other cheek, that doesn't therefore contradict the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, when it says, well, if someone hurts you, eye for an eye, right? They have to be punished accordingly, right? So what is Marcion's argument? If that's Tertullian's response, what must Marcion's argument have been? Why can the God of the Hebrew Bible and the God of Christianity not be the same God?
Because you either have to have eye for an eye or...
Yeah, exactly. These are contradictory principles, says Marcion. You can't say that if you commit a crime, you have to be punished for it, and then at the same time say, turn the other cheek. Right? Either it's one or it's the other. It can't be the same. And Marcion, if you go through Tertullian and you go through some of the other works of the heresiologists, you'll see that Marcion seems to have compiled, either officially in a work or maybe just this was the effect of his teachings, seems to have compiled a list of all the cases where the Hebrew Bible, according to him, conflicts with Jesus' teachings. And on this basis, Marcion asserted that there were two different gods. Now, okay, so if this is Marcion's theology in a nutshell, if this is sort of Marcionite docetism, so who cares, right? Why would anyone be bothered by this? So, first and most basically, say that there are two gods is quite a claim. It needs to be justified. But in addition, take a look at Tertullian here. The second passage from Tertullian is, so Marcion, even more of an antichrist, seized upon this assumption, being better equipped, in fact, for denial of Christ's corporal substance, and that he had postulated that even Christ's God was neither the creator of flesh, nor would raise it to life again. In this, too, supremely good and entirely divergent from the lies and deceptions of the creator. Thus also, the sufferings of Marcion's Christ will fail to find credence. One who has not truly suffered has not suffered at all, and a phantasm cannot have truly suffered. Right, so what is Tertullian's problem here? So remember, Marcion claims that there are two gods. Jesus comes from the second one, the more important one. And in fact, he is not a human at all. He's just the manifestation of that God. He seems to be a human, but he's not really. So if Jesus is not really a man, so Jesus could not have
suffered
like a man, right? Now, it was very important to many Christians, and in particular the Proto-Orthodox, that Jesus have suffered, right? Because that was the entire symbolism of whatever it is that he's accomplishing, right? So in order to argue that Jesus suffered and so forth, so you also need to argue that Jesus was capable of suffering. So Marcion says, well, so rather Tertullian says, if Marcion thinks that Jesus is not a man, so my knee who's suffering, right? In other words, like, this is, who cares, right? Okay. Now, this was the problem that the heresiologists had with Marcion, and the reason why they spill so much ink attacking Marcion is because, as Justin Martyr tells us, take a look at the next source, writing in the middle of the 2nd century. So by this time, in the middle of the 2nd century is a bare 100 or some odd years after the death of Jesus. Even by this time, says Justin, and he, by the aid of the devils, had caused many of every nation to speak blasphemies and to not deny that God is the maker of this universe and to assert that some other being greater than he had done greater works. Justin thinks that Marcion is having a bad influence on lots and lots of people. So Marcion is a real threat. And this is a threat that needs to be dealt with. So the question is, how is this threat dealt with? Okay. So with this as a setup, let's take a look at the sources in source number 2. I'm going to turn your attention now to a very famous passage from Luke, the 22nd chapter of Luke. We're going to read it together. And then we're going to look at some of the manuscript evidence that we have, and then we're going to have to ask ourselves some quite difficult questions. Okay, so this is in this story, Jesus is about to be arrested and then eventually crucified. So before he does so, one thing that we have in common in our gospel, certainly Mark and Luke have this tradition that Jesus prays before he is arrested that he should either not have to suffer or that the suffering shouldn't be so terrible or whatever the case may be. So in Luke's tradition, now, you know, Mark, Matthew, and Luke have things in common. That's why they're called the Synoptic Gospels. They can be read together and you can sort of mix and match them. But they also contradict each other many times. And this is one of those cases, as we'll see in a moment. So Luke tells us, Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives and his disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, "Pray that you will not fall into temptation." He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down and prayed, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will but yours be done." An angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him, and being in anguish, the Greek word there is agonia, as we'll see that's important in a moment, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat, his idros, was like drops, thromboi, of blood falling to the ground. When he rose from prayer and went back to the disciples, he found them asleep, exhausted from sorrow. "Why are you sleeping?" he asked them. "Get up and pray so that you will not fall into temptation." So what happens here, Jesus prays, he says, "Please let me not suffer, but if I have to suffer, so nishkeferlach, this is not so bad. God, your will be done, not mine." Then, as he's praying, an angel comes and gives him chizuk because he sees that he's in so much pain, and he's in such pain that he's sweating out droplets of blood. His sweat is so profuse that it looks like drops of blood falling onto the ground. And then he derives some sort of chizuk from this angel, and he goes back and tells his disciples to get up and so forth. Now, this is where the expression, which expression is derived from this passage?
Sweating blood.
Sweating blood, right? This is where sweating blood comes from. So, in this passage, we are given a whole story. Now take a look to the right. We're going to look at one of them, but you'll have to trust me that both of them give the exact same evidence. So the first one here, this is one of our earliest pieces. This is one of our earliest papyrus witnesses to the text of Luke. It's called P75, Papyrus Bodmer. It was written in the late 2nd, early 3rd century CE. We can assume, and in fact, the next witness that I have down below also was a very early text. So we can assume that this reflects the text that people would have had, let's say, in the mid-2nd century, right? Or maybe a little bit later. So right at the time as Justin is writing and as a little bit after Irenaeus is writing and so on and so forth. So if you look, you'll have to trust me, this is what the Greek says. But the Greek says here, plain metafelima mu alatasun genestho. So those are the Greek words for Yet not my will be done, but yours. Rather, yet not my will, but yours be done. Right, which is the end, if you'll recall, of verse 42. Then the very next words on the line are Kayanastas, Apo, and so forth. When he rose from prayer and went back to the disciples, he found them asleep. So what happened? We skipped from the end of 42, right to the beginning of 45. What happened? So all of the story of the angel and sweating blood and him being in pain, great pain, are gone. What happened? And if you look down in the next piece of papyrus, you'll see that the very same thing is true there. So if you turn the page over, so the question we have to ask ourselves when something like this happens is we basically have two options about what happened here. What may have happened? What are the two options?
Either it's lost or it was edited.
Exactly. Either someone added something to the text or someone deleted something from the text. Right? Okay.
But they didn't copy it right.
Right. It may have been a mistake. Right. It's possible.
Transcription.
Right. It's possible there was a mistake that happened here. Or it's possible that somebody added something into the text. We have to ask ourselves which one of these is most likely. So take a look at the passage from Mark that I've given you. This is the parallel passage from Mark. It's telling you the same, it's narrating the same event. You'll see with somewhat different details, but it's narrating the same event. And what I'd like to do here is read the passage from Mark, and then we're going to point out all the differences between Luke and Mark, and I'm going to ask us to sort of sum up the differences by figuring out what is the message, if you will, or what's the mood that is present in Mark, and what is the mood that is present in Luke. So take a look at Mark's version. They went to a place called Gethsemane, right? This is the famous Garden of Gethsemane story. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." And going a little farther, he fell to the ground and he prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Okay. What are some of the differences? Major differences. So there are narrative differences. There are details that I don't think are that important. One is on the Mount of Olives, one is in the Garden of Gethsemane. In one case, it talks about Peter, James, and John. In the other case, it doesn't. What are some of the key motifs that are different? So they're praying also, right? That's true. So they pray at the end of Luke, but yes, correct.
There's no angel.
There's no angel, right? That's true. The whole scene that we're talking about is missing in Mark. What about the details? What is Jesus' attitude in Mark as opposed to that in Luke?
He says that he's very, very sorrowful. He doesn't say anything.
Yeah, he's sorrowful even to death. That's missing from Luke.
He's saying that. Here he says nothing.
Right. So in Mark, he says, "I'm sorrowful even to death." And Luke, that whole thing is missing. In Mark, what else? As you said, he's also troubled. Mark says he's very distressed, he's troubled, he's freaking out. In Mark, Jesus is not happy about what's going to happen. In Luke, Jesus is not distressed and troubled. He's not sorrowful even to death. And in fact, let's bracket that for a second. If we bracket 43 and 44, right? If we bracket 43, 44, the picture that we have of Jesus in Luke, and again, when Luke compare verse 41 in Luke, "He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down and prayed," with 35 in Mark, "And going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed." What's the difference there? What's the difference between he knelt down and he fell down?
One sounds like
he's doing it calmly, collected emotions, and one sounds like he's having a heart attack, right? So other than 43 and 44 in Luke, the picture that we get in Mark, which is the earlier gospel, is Jesus as freaking out about what's going to happen to him. This is true of all of Mark. Jesus, if you read Mark, it's not clear that Jesus understands what is going to happen to him. And it's not even clear after the crucifixion that Jesus understands what's happened to him. It's not clear at all. Jesus is very much in the dark. In Luke, and this is true throughout Luke, Jesus is calm. Even at his trial, he's worried about everybody else. He's concerned for this person's soul and blah, blah, blah. So the picture that we get from Luke, whenever Luke changes Mark, he's usually changing it to make Jesus seem calmer. This 43 and 44 makes Jesus seem much more like a Mark type of like a Mark type of Jesus. And moreover, those three Greek words that I highlighted for you in the Luke passage are actually what we would call, what linguists would call, or scholars would call, hapax legomena. Hapax legomena means that they are the only time this word appears in the entire text. These words don't appear anywhere else in Luke. These words are unique to Luke, right? So the yeah, right. Well, legomena is a participle in Greek, which means saying, right? These things are said, right? Yeah, exactly, right. So these are words that are unique in Luke. So the situation we have is a case where we have two verses in Luke that don't appear in early manuscripts that are very out of character in terms of how Luke portrays Jesus and that use words that don't appear anywhere else in Luke. So why are these? So what is this doing here? So if we have to conclude something, the evidence seems to point quite deliberately in favor of the view that these verses have, that this story of sweating blood was introduced into Luke at a later point. Now the question is, why? Right, so what does it contribute to to Christian, proto-Christian theology if Jesus is sweating blood and is freaking out and is really in agony? What does that contribute?
Well, he's
human.
Yeah,
he's human.
Excellent. He's human, right? He's human and he's capable of agony. He's capable of suffering. And in fact, take a look at Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr, writing in the second century, right when our evidence suggests that this verse was being introduced into the text, this is how Justin Martyr uses those verses. He says, "For in the memoirs, which I say were drawn up by his apostles and those who followed them," in the Gospels, says Justin Martyr, "it is recorded that his sweat fell down like drops of blood while he was praying and saying, 'If it be possible, let this cup pass.' His heart and also his bones trembling, his heart being like wax melting in his belly, in order that we may perceive that the Father wished his Son really to undergo such sufferings for our sakes, and may not say that he, being the Son of God, did not feel what was happening to him and inflict it on him." So the whole point of these verses, as Justin Martyr uses them, is to prove that Marcion is wrong, that the Docetists are wrong, that Jesus really is a man and he's capable of suffering and so on and so forth. So we can see that the way that these texts are being treated at an early stage, but for some time after they have been written, is people feel free to introduce changes into them for theological purposes because they want to score theological points in a battle between what they perceive as good and evil. So these texts are being treated rather fluidly even at this stage. This, I think, is the... Now, we could multiply
you
this example.
You draw that from, say, for in the memoirs, which I say were drawn up by his apostles, but I thought that's...
My apologies. It's right at this point that the original recording cut off. We only realized this after the class concluded, but what I'd like to do now is supplement the rest of the class. Unfortunately, it's going to be outside of the context of the classroom format per se, so we're going to lose some of the spontaneity, we're going to lose some of the back and forth that I think makes this such a worthwhile endeavor. But for the nonce, we're going to have to be satisfied with a secondarily pleasing format. So where we cut off was Mr. Blank asked an excellent question about the passage that we were examining in Justin, which is that Justin... cites this passage from Luke, the sweating blood passage, as if it's scripture. Now we had used that Justin passage to indicate that in fact this was a late interpolation into the text of Luke. So Mr. Blank asked, but if that was the case, then how come Justin seems to have this passage in his Luke and seems to trace it back to the original authorship of that gospel? So I would simply answer that the evidence that we have here from Justin is precisely bearing on the question that we've asked, which is that, again, we have a text in Luke that looks either as if it has been edited down from a longer version to a shorter version, and whether purposefully or by mistake, or we have a text that initially was shorter and had something and had someone or some group of people come along and augment that text with some extra text. Now, either way, whether original text fell out or whether non-original text was added in, we can pretty clearly date this change, however it may occur, to the, about, let's say, the mid-second century of the Common Era, because, of course, it's at this time that we have evidence, for example, here in Justin, of people who do have this text in their gospel, and we have other evidence, like the papyrus, the papyrological evidence, the manuscript evidence that we analyzed above, for people who for whom this text clearly was not in their gospel. So it's clear that somebody here is dealing with an inauthentic textual tradition, and the only question is who. So so what we use Justin for in this case is to show us that somebody who did have this text, whether correctly or incorrectly, what he was using that text for. And it's clear that the purpose to which Justin applied this text in Luke, this questionable text in Luke, was precisely to show that the Docetists are wrong. Now, so since our evidence in any event, whether because of the papyrological evidence, or because of the comparisons with Mark, or because of the internal issues with these additions in Luke using words that appear nowhere else in Luke, so since all of this evidence in any event suggests that these passages are suspect and that they have been added, what we're using Justin to do is to demonstrate why, or rather to provide us with a sense of evidence as to why this passage might have been added. And what we are arguing is that these passages were added as a hammer to club away at the Marcionites with, to club away at the Docetists with. So what we can see, given all of this, is that it's clear that within this sort of Christian textual tradition, we would need to be careful before we analogize from this particular case to all other cases. But we can at least see that we have an example here of within the tradition of the preservation of what would come to be known as the Gospel of Luke, that it's clear that those who are preserving this textual tradition felt, in some respect, free to add text, or in some other cases perhaps to delete text from the gospel tradition. But we should note that the propensity now, and here we're going to have to broaden our, as we said in the beginning, we're going to have to broaden our investigative scope beyond just the Christian text, because of course, as we've been saying for so long, Christianity really fits best within the matrix of early Judaism. So we should really consider Luke, the Gospel of Luke as it was originally written, and to some extent its textual transmission as coming from within a Jewish context. So now we can kind of broaden our investigation and ask ourselves, did this sort of textual fluidity adhere only for quote-unquote new texts, like the kind that we've just examined with Luke, or did they perhaps apply to even older, more venerable texts, like those that we examined last week? So we should note that the propensity for, let's say, ideological alterations being inserted willy-nilly into sacred texts can actually also be found among those who used the Hebrew Bible itself. So, for example, let's examine in the sources in source number 3 the tradition of the Samaritan Pentateuch. The Samaritans, their origins are, in some respect, shrouded in mystery, but there are people who live in the land of Israel who are considered at some point to sort of be inauthentic Jews, but they certainly identify with the God of Israel and preserve rather idiosyncratic, from our perspective, idiosyncratic traditions about the God of Israel. But what they share in common with us is the heritage of Chumash. Now, the Samaritans preserve a particular textual tradition of what Chumash says, and often the text that they preserve is different than the Masoretic text, the text of the Baalei HaMasorah, And oftentimes, or at least sometimes, this textual tradition can be found also in Qumran fragments that are not necessarily Samaritan. But other times, and this is going to be one of those cases, the editors of the Samaritan Pentateuch clearly made deliberate changes to texts simply because they didn't fit their theology or their ideological presuppositions. For example, take a look at the sources in source number 3. So the source that I've given you in source number 3 is from the Masoretic text, but it's shared with all other textual traditions, rather, for which we have evidence, except, as we'll see, just one. But the pasuk reads, Ki im el ha-makom asher yivchar Hashem alokeichem, mikol shifteichem lasum es shemo sham, l'shichno sidrashu vasa shama. The pasuk in Devarim, which is describing the eventual implantation of the Mikdash in the city that God will choose. Now, we know in retrospect that the city that God chose is Yerushalayim, and that makes sense within the context of Devarim, because, of course, Yerushalayim had not been encountered yet in any of the narrative of Chumash, so it would make sense to call it the place that God will eventually choose. This, however, was problematic for the Samaritans, because, of course, for the Samaritans, the city where God intended to construct or to have constructed his Mikdash was not Yerushalayim at all, but rather was Shechem. Now, has Shechem appeared before in the biblical narrative? And the answer, of course, is yes. Shechem has appeared earlier in Bereishis and so forth. So it would not make sense to call Shechem the Makom Asher Yivchar, the place that God will choose, because, of course, in the narrative of the Samaritan Pentateuch, God already has chosen Shechem as the place where he will one day have his Mikdash constructed. And so, of course, in the Samaritan Pentateuch, sure enough, you're going to find the following. Take a look in that source to the right of the Pasuk in Devarim. Ki im el ha-makom asher bachar Hashem alokeichem mikol shifteichem lasim es shemo sham l'shichno sidrashu vasam shama. So aside from the other minor differences, the major difference is that the city where God will establish his Mikdash is not called Makom Asher Yivchar, the place that God will choose, but the Makom Asher Bachar, the place that God already chose. So here, of course, we have another example of an ideological alteration introduced into the text of what is presumptively a book that is not only holy, but is or considered sacred, but is viewed as such by sort of the common collective of Jews, at least by the end of the Second Temple period and presumably earlier. So the question we have to ask ourselves now is, well, we can establish that this is done in the context of the gospel that would eventually be called Luke. We can establish that this is done in the case of even of Chumash for the Samaritans, but of course for them there was dire need. But does this apply at all? Does this apply at all to the tradition that is perpetuated by the Baalei HaMasorah, or alternatively by Chazal? Can we find perhaps in the traditions of which ours is an offshoot of the same phenomena? So let's look at this from the perspective of Chazal. And in fact, in some of our midrashic sources from late antiquity, we actually encounter a tradition of a particular practice that looks somewhat similar to this. So, for example, take a look in the sources in source number 4. This is from the Midrash Tanchuma, about the... It's basically a 5th century text, even if it has later additions and so forth, but it in certain cases preserves ancient traditions as well. But the Pasuk here says, L'gev of Avazeno, Eini hayalo lomar, Ela shekinehu hakasav kalomar kivyachol klapim alan v'chinei hakasav shehu tikkun sofrim anshei kneses hagadola. So the pasuk from Zechariah refers to whoever touches you touches the apple of his eye. Now the verse should have stated, because God is referring to the Jewish people as the apple of an eye, should have said the apple of my eye, because of course the Jewish people are the apple of God's eye. So the verse should have stated my eye, but instead scripture states his eye. Scripture used a euphemism as if to claim the impossibility of referring to God. And the euphemism under discussion here is a correction of the scribes, is a tikkun sofrim of the men of the great assembly. So here, the Tanchuma refers to the tradition of tikkun sofrim. Tikkun sofrim is the notion that early scribes, rabbanim, had introduced, in this case, a deliberate change into the original text of the Torah, and they had done so for ideological reasons. In this case, to prevent, let's say, disrespect or a cavalier attitude towards the Kadosh Baruch Hu. So in the Tanchuma, we can see that there certainly is a tolerance for the notion that deliberate changes, not just sort of a tolerance for error, but a tolerance for even deliberate changes introduced into the text of Tanakh are here tolerated. But the counter-argument might be made that, well, here the changes are just sort of all single-letter changes, a no instead of a ni. But of course, if you take a look at the source below this from Bereishis Rabba, perhaps a little bit earlier, we find another phenomenon that's also referred to as Tikkun Sofrim. The Pasuk says, V'Avraham Odenu Omed Lefnei Hashem, Amra Bisimin, Tikkun Sofrim Zeh, Shechina Mamtenes LaAvraham. Rather, the Bereishis Rabba, the Midrash, tells us, Avraham stood yet before the Lord. Rabbi Simon said, it is a correction of the scribes, for in reality, the divine presence was waiting for Avraham. So here, we're told that originally, the order of the narrative order of the words of the Torah was that God was waiting around, and then Avraham showed up. But because this was thought to be insufficiently respectful of God's role as the master of the universe, Chazal came along and corrected this order so that it reads, as we have it nowadays in our texts, that Avraham stood yet before the Lord. In other words, to reflect the notion that God wasn't waiting for Avraham, it was in fact the other way around. So here, this is much more substantial than just changing a letter here or there. Here, the entire order, the entire word order of a pasuk, or even potentially more than one pasuk, has been altered, all in the name, or subsumed under the justification of Tikkun Sofrim, the prerogative that early Rabbanan, or early scribes at least, had to introduce changes. So, we've seen this sort of phenomenon in the gospel eventually known as Luke. We've seen this in the Samaritan Pentateuch, and we've seen it amongst rabbinic literature as well. So what are we to make of all of this? And here I want to bring this full circle into conversation with I think problems of pressing contemporary import. The notion that changes can be introduced into a text are reflective, certainly, we should say at the outset, of a certain attitude towards even very sacred texts, which is that they are amenable in some sense to deliberate change, not just change via error, but deliberate change. But in fact, I would argue that just as we said last time when we compared the halachic process with the process of the preservation of the Torah, so here I think we can make a similar analogy. Just as in the concept, just as rather in the realm of halacha, we have the notion of, let's say, hora'as shah, where halacha might be changed or even violated. Even usually this is temporary, but in at least one or two cases this is permanent. For example, the notion that Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral Torah, can be written down. This seems to be a permanent hora'as shah, if you will, which might be an oxymoron, but a permanent change in halacha. So there are times where the halacha can be deliberately altered if there is sufficient need. So conceivably, there might be good reason to alter, similarly, even the words of Tanakh. It's not out of the realm of possibility. And in fact, as we've seen, Chazal were aware that this might happen, or that scribes might treat the text of Tanakh this way. However, and here is where I think we can distinguish the phenomenon of Tikkun Sofrim from the phenomena that we encountered beforehand, Chazal's tendency seems to have been to try and identify precisely where either inaccuracies in the Torah's text occurred and eliminate them, as we saw last week, or, if appropriate, and sort of on the contrary, and in a case, let's say, where the gains of a change might outweigh the cost, Chazal might note that a change in the text has occurred and simply leave their calling card, as it were. So in other words, we have two types of changes that can occur in the text that Chazal recognized can occur in the text of the Torah. One is a change via error, which we dealt with last week, and one is a change that is deliberate. And it's this change that we're concerned with now. So here, we should simply note that what Tikkun Sofrim does for us, the phenomenon of Tikkun Sofrim, is that unlike in the case, let's say, of Luke or the Samaritan Pentateuch, where we had to go hunting for changes, here, Chazal signposts the change. They note that the change has occurred. And I believe that this is done, or at the very least, in sort of a William Jamesian sense, we can look at if not the root of this practice, we can at least look at the fruit of this practice. The fruit of this practice of Tikkun Sofrim is that future generations now have access to the process that went into shaping our scriptural tradition. We know that a certain change has occurred via the method of Tikkun Sofrim. And this ensures maximum accountability. Because, of course, maximum accountability was always of crucial importance to Chazal. And in fact, we know from a variety of other instances in Chazal that Chazal developed other, less intrusive means of accomplishing the very same thing. In other words, circumscribing a text because the need was felt to be so great that such needed to be done. So, for example, in the case of Tikkun Sofrim, it's clear that the threat to God's honor was so weighty, at least in that particular context, that change needed to be introduced into the text. So there are other times where there are similarly weighty concerns, and Chazal found ways other than Tikkun Sofrim to protect the dignity, to protect the integrity of whatever value they felt was at stake, by means other than changing the text. So, for example, setting preconditions for the study of certain, let's say, challenging texts in Tanakh, like, for instance, the Parsha of Arayos, of forbidden sexual relationships, or the Maaseh HaMerkava, the chariot vision in Yecheskel, and all of this is detailed, of course, in the first Mishnah of the second parak of Chagiga. Or by preserving, and this is really the modus operandi of the Pharisees and later of the rabbis, one way to ensure that the integrity of the text could be preserved, even while crucial additions to the text of the Torah Simpliciter could be preserved, would be by preserving extra scriptural traditions or augmentations of biblical law and biblical theology as completely separate from scripture. So, for example, one of the hallmarks of the Pharisees, as Josephus describes them to us, is that whenever they preserve traditions or laws or practices or even perhaps theological points that are not present in the biblical text, at least in a simple sense, or perhaps even at all, they preserve them not by sort of forcibly inserting them into Chumash, or by altering the text of Chumash or of other books of the Tanakh, such that they might seem to have always appeared there. Instead, they preserve them as extra scriptural traditions, as what Josephus calls the traditions of the fathers, and that what perhaps in later in a different guise, rabbinic literature might later call halachos, or even later than that, halachal Moshe Misinai. There are certain traditional laws or practices or beliefs that are not to be found in Chumash, and rather than stepping them into Chumash, Chazal preserve them apart from Chumash to mark them as what they are, even while at the very same time affirming their equal importance. And because the reason I think Chazal do this is because, of course, without this insurance of accountability, without leaving us a paper trail such that we can reconstruct the process by which, on the one hand, Chazal preserve their values and at the same time treat the Torah and the text of the Torah with the utmost seriousness that it deserves, it's all too easy, I think, to make sort of convenient ideological manipulation of a text into a habit that just occurs all the time. without any notice, without any accountability. And this, I think, is what actually occurs in the context of Marcion and perhaps with the Samaritan Pentateuch. Once you make a habit of changing texts just so that they fit preconceived notions and not noting that these changes have occurred, it becomes easy to make this into a habit. And in rabbinic literature, what we find, even though these changes can occur and are admitted to occur, what we find is an insistence that a paper trail be left, even when these changes are made. And in fact, I think this notion, the importance of maximum transparency, maximum accountability, is crucial in the context of our own community as well. Even as we're aware of the importance at times of going to great lengths to protect the dignity and the sanctity of the Torah, we understand that in a world such as ours, especially a world in which communal authority and communal cohesiveness is under increasing threat, it is of absolute central importance that we demand both from ourselves and from our leaders an ironclad commitment to the notion of accountability. And I believe that this is the lesson, if you will, of the deliberate changes into text that we've observed over the course of this lecture. And with that, I bid you a good morning. But in the context of the verisimilitude of the shir that we're now preserving, it would be a good night.